When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elia Connie.
Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If where we're headed is trying to intentionally cultivate the full potential that people have, you need a different frame than the assumptions that underpin traditional psychometrics.
Hello, and welcome to the Psychology Podcast. Today, we welcome Todd Rose to the show. Todd is the co-founder and president of Populous, a nonprofit think tank that works to find solutions to redistribute opportunity so all people have the chance to live fulfilling lives in a thriving society. Prior to Populous, he was a faculty member at Harvard University, where he founded the Laboratory for the Science of Individuality and directed the Mind, Brain, and Education program. Todd is the best-selling author of Dark Horse and The End of Average, and his most recent book is called Collective Illusions. What you're about to hear today is part one of a two-part series. Todd and I had so much to talk about that we had to split it up into two parts. Today, you'll hear our common interests in redefining intelligence and the amazingly important work Todd has done along those lines. Todd has argued that we really need to move away from these traditional metrics of measuring intelligence and valuing general cognitive ability and what he refers to as jagged profiles, which all of us have. You know, all of us have amazing areas of strengths and amazing areas of weaknesses, or profound areas of weaknesses. So I really like Todd's model of looking at intelligence, because it really does emphasize the point that there's no such thing as average. So without further ado, I bring you Todd Rose. Hey, Todd, it's so great to have you on the Psychology Podcast today.
Hey, thanks for having me, Scott.
I've wanted to talk to you for quite some time now, and on this podcast. I love your work. You know, we're obviously going to talk about your new work, but can I just start a second and go back to your original work and the experiences you had in education? Because I know we really bond over that. And would you mind kind of talking a little bit about how you felt as a student? Are you okay talking about this, or you've moved completely on?
It's funny, you know, you and I have very similar stories. And in my case, you know, I was a professor for quite a long time, got my doctorate from Harvard. But before that, I was a high school dropout. And it's funny, at this point, I'd say when I say a high school dropout, I actually failed out with a 0.9 GPA, which I kind of feel like now that, like, you have to work really hard to do that poorly.
You have to be willful.
Yeah. Just to not even get the social promotion right out of it all. But, you know, not too long after filling out, my girlfriend, who's still my wife today, found out she was pregnant. So I was high school dropout with a kid on the way. And, you know, it just, look, what I experienced through most of education was just how poor of a fit it was between this sort of standardized institution and me as an individual. And for a long time, I just internalized that as something wrong with me. And it wasn't until out of like sheer desperation, I was able to go to get my GED, go to college, figure out how to make it work for myself. And then I ended up at Harvard working with a guy named Kurt Fischer, who was like this preeminent scholar. Yeah. And in this science of the individual, and realized that actually so much of it was more in the design of the institutions that were built around an average person that we now knew didn't exist. And so it really actually made me quite angry, because I felt like I'd internalized so much of that poor fit as a reflection of me and my abilities. And so that really fueled me in terms of wanting to really dive into this new science and understand individuality and what that means for not just education, but like it's already transforming, you know, things like nutrition, you know, cancer research and treatment, you know, all of precision medicine. So, you know, out of personal experience, you know, fueled intellectual curiosity that led to my career.
Yeah. Thank you, Todd. I was wondering if you'd be okay with us dedicating this episode to Kurt Fischer, to the memory of him. He passed away recently, and may he rest in peace. I've never mentioned this on any of my podcasts, but when I was deciding for grad school, where to go to grad school, the two places I was deciding was to either, I was accepted to work with Kurt Fischer at Harvard or Robert Sternberg at Yale. And that was one of the hardest decisions I've ever had to make, but so easily I could have ended up at Harvard and have been your colleague. So
we would have been funny. I'm not saying you made the bad choice, but
right. No, that it could have happened.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah, look, I mean, it was
like,
I'm so glad.
So easy.
Yeah. I'm so glad to dedicate. Yeah, that it's Kurt was a brilliant scholar. My life would be completely different without him as a mentor. You know, I dedicated End of Average, one of my previous books, to him. And he was such a kind person too. Like just such a wonderful human being. So thank you.
Agreed. Absolutely agreed. And his work was pretty revolutionary in the field of developmental psychology and his thinking about intelligence. And that was the main inroad that I had with him. Was I was this like 22-year-old kid who was like, I want to redefine intelligence. I didn't know how, but I wanted to. I was like, we got to redefine intelligence. And I didn't have it all figured out yet. Not like I have it all figured out now. But what I really liked about his approach was this kind of like very, it was like micro, like looking at the moments, the full process of the creative process, and at a really detailed level that allow us to more fully capture what it means to be human. Could you maybe talk a little bit about his approach that he pioneered, the methodological approach, which is quite innovative?
Yeah, so his specific theory was dynamic skill theory, right? And to your point, like, and it was situated in broader dynamic systems theory. And, you know, it's so funny because psychology in general is one of the few fields that was born out of statistics in some way, right? Like it's like, but statistics is funny, right? Because my dad, who's an engineer, he said, you know, what's really funny about psychology is it's like the only field he felt like that uses math that abstracts away from the phenomenon you're actually trying to understand, right? Like you're trying, most psychology is about understanding individual human beings. Otherwise we'd be sociology, right? And yet we rely on statistical methods that absolutely cannot tell you anything about individuals. They can tell you about groups. And then we just assume that it says something about individuals. And so Kurt was part of a small group of people who were starting to think about the application of dynamic systems theory and some of these, or these methodologies that were capable of modeling individuals and thinking about how that you could scale up an entire science that gave you generalizable statements starting with individuals. And Kurt's application of that was to development, which is kind of funny, right? Because development is by definition change, right? And yet we're using methods that are incapable of modeling change. So, you know, and so what was so fascinating and amazing about Kurt's work, and I actually think dynamic skill theory, it was so far ahead of its time that it will become more and more mainstream as the years go on. But his ability to model an individual with their full complexity, right? The multidimensionality of a human being, and importantly, in context, right? Because so much of psychology abstracts away from the context, and we talk about personality types or things like that. And what Kurt was able to show is It just, you can't describe behavior that way. And if you start to take person in context seriously, not only can you get accurate statements, your predictive power goes way up. And so I just, you know, it taught me a lot about how to see the world. And man, I can't say enough about it. Just how grateful I am to have been able to be in that kind of intellectual environment. Not so much Harvard, although I liked Harvard, the environment Kirk created, the way he would push us to think for ourselves and do big things. And then one of the things he did that was so remarkable was when he founded the Mind Brain Education Program with Howard Gardner, he intentionally said, we are never going to be at each other's throats. So many other programs pit students against students. And he created a culture with norms where we really had each other's backs and we were proud of each other. And to this day, you know, just the friends that I have that were, I'm not trying to make you feel bad for making the wrong choice, but
I feel, I know I'm like, did I make the wrong choice?
I'm on your podcast. So something went right.
Yeah. But it's wonderful. It's really wonderful to hear about that. And I'd like to double click a little bit on your unique contributions as well, which have been very significant. We're obviously both standing on the shoulders of the giants that are Kurt Fischer, Harold Gardner, Robert Sternberg, et cetera. But I love your own way of thinking about this. To answer this question about your own theory, I want to go in by asking this. Do you see any value to the standard psychometric model of IQ testing? Do you see any value in the standard model before we get to your model?
I do not. Look, I mean, I guess that might be too harsh, right? Like, here's my problem with it. It's like, what are we trying to do, right? Like, so much measurement, we forget, like, what really is our goal? And a lot of the standard psychometric models, you know, they made assumptions about human beings that are demonstrably false now, right? So we can forgive them whether they realize that back then or not. And most of it is really about trying to compare people with either other people or a hypothetical average person, right? So that you get a nice bell curve and we can say something about your relative rank. Okay, look, is there some value to that? I don't know. I don't see a lot of value in it. I'm open to the idea that there's some value that I'm just blind to. But what's frustrating to me is, in my mind, whether in education, the point should be the cultivation of human potential, the cultivation of uniqueness and potential, and helping people convert that into contribution. In that case, I need to know more about you as Scott, your aspirations, your abilities. And from my perspective and from Kurt's perspective, who I learned it from, you're not separating ability independent of context is kind of a silly statement, right? Like, and so I want to know who you are, what you care about, your, what we would call like a Jagged profile of abilities, and then work like crazy to create an environment that really fits you so that you can develop your full potential, make your best contribution. If that's the aim, then a lot of traditional psychometric models they fall short, right? I guess is the most generous way I could describe it.
Thank you for elucidating that. I love the idea of a jagged profile. The psychometrics can still help you understand a person's jagged profile though, right? Because I got a lot of educational opportunities inhibited. Like I, a lot of things were shut down for me because of my global IQ score. But interestingly enough, a couple years ago, my friend Rex Jung, the neuroscientist of intelligence, he's like, I don't buy that you're stupid. I want to look at your brain. And so I went to University of Mexico and he gave me a full battery IQ test. He gave me a brain scan, everything. And the conclusion, which I wish my 10-year-old school psychologist looked at, is that the real interesting data was in the jagged profile. It was the fact that I really stuck legitimately at visual mental rotation. It's true. And I can own that. But and I say this with all due humility, but this is objective, verbally gifted. Verbally gifted. Yeah. So they totally missed that. I mean, even though I loved writing, I wrote novels when I was 8 years old, 9 years old, but all that was ignored. All that was ignored because of the global IQ score. So I think this is your point, right? To a large degree.
And what's great, here's the thing. So now I'll come back from the extreme because I think you're exactly right. Look,
Yeah.
When we
the
think
problem
about
is with the global IQ score. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's funny because we've known that since the very first days of IQ testing, that when you look at subscores and their patterns, right, there's just massive individual variation. And we just willfully ignore that, right? Because here's the thing. One reason why I believe we ignored it is it's very hard to rank patterns, but I can rank a single score. And if what I'm trying to do is rank people, what do I do with a Jagged profile, right? But what you see is, and what we find is, like, this is true. I wrote about it in End of Average, whether it's body size or mental abilities, people all have these Jagged profiles, meaning, like, so something like body size is not one dimensional, right? We think of it that way, small, medium, large, extra large. It doesn't work that way, really. That's just a shortcut because of production constraints, right? So everybody's on the high end on some aspects of, like, size is multidimensional. And what's fascinating is that those dimensions just don't correlate with each other like we like to think they do. So it means that you're going to be high on some things, in the middle on other things, and on the low end on other things, right? Everybody. Like, and you know, the US Air Force learned that the hard way in the 50s when trying to design fighter jet cockpits, right? That didn't really fit anybody. But in the mental space, you know, to your point. So the most interesting thing to know about you is the Jagged profile, right? And this is not to say that people don't have weaknesses. Of course, we all do. Everybody does. And so now, so understanding that profile starts to tell me something. But then the question again is, what am I trying to do with that information? And traditionally, and maybe it's not the psychometric methods so much as the intention of the people that were creating them, it was like, I don't really care about that. I just need to find the people who are sort of gifted, who deserve more resources, right? It's like a sorting mechanism. Okay, so let's take even the Jagged profile. Well, if you ignore context, then you're still in trouble, right? So I'll share a story with you, because it's funny because people think it's a good thing for me, but it's hilarious. So remember that on the GRE, I don't know when you took it. When I took it, it had, you know, quantitative, the verbal, and then they had the analytical reasoning, which I don't think they have anymore, but it was like, they'd give you these questions like...
I was,
it was brutal.
I got almost a 0% on the analytical, and the same year, they switched it, they added the writing thing, and then I got almost a perfect on the writing. So I was able, so lucky to not submit the 0%. This story's in the gifted, actually. I have the story in ungifted.
It's unbelievable, right? So here's my story. So I have gone from a high school dropout, 0.9 GPA. I am about to graduate from Weber State University with a 3.97, honor student of the year. My advisors said you should apply to grad school. I'm the only person in my family to ever go to grad school there back at that point. I didn't know anything about that. And I have to take this standardized test, and I suck at standardized tests, right? Well, I went on Saturdays to these prep sessions, and I was taking all the practice exams. And like you, so I finally got up the quant score and the verbal score to like reasonable, you know, okay, I won't be laughed out of the room. Yeah. And up until 2 weeks before I had to take the actual exam, I had never scored higher than the 13th percentile on the analytical reasoning. Because it was just, I could not get my head around it. It's like,
so hard.
Farmer John has four rows of things, and corn can't be by peas, and peas can only be second, whatever. And then it'd be like, okay, what's planted in row 3, like third from the left? I'm like,
I know.
Wow, I don't know. Okay, so here's what's crazy, and there is a real point to this. So I'm sitting there thinking, okay, well, I'm just not analytical, right? Like, it is what it is, but I'm certainly not going to get into grad school. Like, probably not. You would not go to Yale with a zero on this. And I was like, so I'm at my parents' house trying to study because we lived in a 400 square foot apartment with kids. So I had to go there to study for it. And I was so frustrated 2 weeks before I had to take it that I flung my pencil across the room. You shouldn't do that, right? I control myself. But like, as my dad walked in and about hits him, and he's just like, what's wrong with you? And I finally told him, I said, like, I don't get this, and I'm really frustrated. And he's an engineer by training, and he walks over and he looks at it and he goes, well, that's a degrees of freedom problem. And I'm like, yeah, that doesn't help me. I don't know what that is, right? Like, and he said, well, how are you trying to do that? And I tell him I was trying to do it in my head. And he said, well, you have terrible working memory, which is definitely true. He said, well, there's a visual way to do this. And he said, look, and he shows me this diagram. He said, use that. And I tried it on one problem and it was really easy. And I'm like, it can't be, right? Like, it can't be that easy. But all the answers I had in the back, you know, every other answer, it kept working for. So I went to the tutor and I said, hey, look, my dad told me I could use this. Does this work? And he goes, well, yeah, I guess you could use it. I just don't need to. That's what he told me. I'm like, wait, okay. So, there's no kidding. I go 2 weeks later and I only missed one question on the entire analytical reasoning section of the
GRE. You went from 13% to like 98%?
Yeah, like 98%.
Is that what you're telling me?
And yes. And so here's the thing. One story could be, look how smart I am in terms of analytical reasoning. The other story, and the one I think is correct, is that there's no such thing as aptitude that doesn't involve strategy. And it's like, understanding that someone with my jagged profile, with poor working memory, a strategy that is related to doing it in your head was going to make me look incompetent. But getting the right strategy applied to my individuality, and suddenly I look like the smartest person in the room. Like, I never forgot that, right? And it's again, it's not about me being smart. It's about recognizing that we all have jagged profiles, and those jagged profiles they're good in some contexts, poor in others, but there is always a strategy that can work for you. And we don't teach kids that, right? Like, so I try something, I don't do very well, I'm not very good at it, right? And to me, that's, whether they meant it or not, that's the legacy of a lot of the psychometric approaches and the way we've chosen to use them in society, is we're left thinking that we're smart or dumb, mediocre, when in fact, as Kurt Fisher would have told anyone who would listen, the truth is a lot more complicated.
Absolutely. When I was an undergrad, I studied with Herb Simon on the expertise approach, and my senior honors thesis, I've never talked about a lot of stuff I'm talking about today on this podcast, but I think you'll appreciate this. My senior honors thesis was looking at isomorphs. I was fascinated with the idea of isomorphs. And I wondered, if you give people like patterns on IQ tests, like A, B, C, what's next, you know, and they get harder and harder, and you take people who are musicians, but you just convert it to musical notes, but it's the same exact pattern. Is there a correlation between your ability to solve it once you have the expertise versus the IQ type item? And I found the correlation was very low. So people could, if they were musical experts and they heard the same complex pattern in music, they were like, oh yeah, dun, 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 dun. The next one is dun. But they couldn't get the same one right if it was just in numbers, you know, there were isomorphs. And so I think this relates to what you're saying to a certain degree, you know, and that was my senior honors thesis.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah. And so think about like what I took away from all this research is we have woefully underestimated human potential, like just woefully underestimated. And maybe that was okay in a standardized industrial society that really didn't have a lot of use for divergent intelligence and diverse outcomes. They just didn't. What do you do with it, right? So what we were doing is trying to come up with tests that could sort people into their social roles, right? And dole out reward and opportunity accordingly in the sort of Frederick Taylor scientific management model. That world is gone now. Like, and we all know that things like creativity and passion and purpose matter. They matter. And what we're seeing is it was our assumptions about human potential that guaranteed the outcomes we were getting. And I'm not saying my view of potential is not, I'm not saying everybody's Einstein. I'm not. I mean, jagged profiles would suggest that we all have some limitations. Like I would love to play in the NFL. I don't have the ability. I would be first admit. Like, it'd be great, right?
You have broad shoulders. You could be a linebacker.
I do. I could. Okay, maybe I could be a linebacker.
Right?
I should.
You have broad shoulders
because I'm 6 feet tall. Yeah. I do. Thank you. And I've been working out. I really appreciate you noticing, Scott.
I can tell.
Like, here's what I'm saying. Everybody is capable of excellence of some form. Everybody. And we do not know in advance what any one person is capable of accomplishing. We just don't. You know, you think about the longitudinal studies using IQ, trying to predict, they predict some things, which is middle management. They're really good at predicting like who will do well in the system we had created. but they miss so much brilliance. And I don't think that that kind of approach is a good national strategy, right? I think that if where we're headed is trying to intentionally cultivate the full potential that people have, you need a different frame than the assumptions that underpin traditional psychometrics.
Yeah. Well, Todd, I couldn't agree with you more. I feel like I'm your brother.
Yeah, no, I'm just following to a certain you degree. Here, buddy. This yeah. is good.
No, this is like, I feel like we're part of the same family here. I love everything you just said. What do you think teachers can do realistically in a classroom? Teachers are incentivized to get their students up to standards, right? So sure. What can we do to equip teachers with the capacity to transcend that?
Yeah, the teachers right now are in the hardest position of any profession that I know, and here's why. Mm-hmm. They are operating in a one-size-fits-all system when that's not really why they got into teaching anyway. I don't know any teacher that was like, what I really wanted was classroom management, right? And teaching to the test. They're stuck there. Meanwhile, what we've seen in our own data at my think tank is privately a revolution in terms of what the public wants and expects out of education. So they don't want better, they want different. They want a system that is doing the kinds of things you and I have been talking about. And they really do. It's across all demographics, that's different, not better, right? And so teachers have a really tough job here because in the constraints of the system as it's structured, it's next to impossible to do the things we're talking about. That doesn't mean we can't make progress, right? And we don't have to write off a whole generation and say, well, look, the next generation, we're going to get it right. We'll transform the system. I think there are three really important things that we can do. The first is actually doing something for teachers, which is this. A lot of human variation that matters when it comes to education is pretty systematic, right? It's not idiosyncratic. It's not one-off. People vary naturally. Let's just take something like their reading ability. In every classroom in the country, kids are going to vary in their reading ability. Well, if you know that in advance, then design the environment to accommodate that variation. Create flexibility in the environment. Education is one of the few industries that still incentivizes average-based design. Think about it. We call it like developmentally appropriate, which sounds good, but it just means what does the average kid of this age know and can do? Well, with our digital technologies—
I hate that phrase. That is,
oh, it's just so, it's I do too. And it's like—
look, I hate that phrase.
So you take something like Universal Design for Learning, which is, this is something that is in federal law. So any school anywhere, any district can do it. It was created by someone named David Rose, who's no relation to me, but was a mentor of mine. That says, here are the dimensions of human variation that matter for learning, and here's how you design for them, right? So if you actually have that built into any curriculum, that's the first step, right? Like, it's like, there should be flexibility here, and we know how to do it, and it's unacceptable that we don't. Second is, there's no substitute for the human relationship. None. Like, I'm a big fan of technology. I think there's things that tech can do better sometimes, especially in the mastery space. But that should always be in service of freeing up time for the teacher-student relationship and the student-student relationship. I'm sure you probably have stories too. For all the bad things I had in school, I am sitting here right now talking to you in part because when I got to college, I had phenomenal individual mentors and teachers who made all the difference in the world, right? So, and the third thing is thinking about student agency, a little more self-determination. I'm not saying Lord of the Flies, whatever the kid wants to do, they get to do. But you can get a really long way ceding a little bit of control to kids, right? Meaningful choice is motivating. Kids persevere on things that they have a say in, right? So I look, all those things we can do right now. And I think if we treated teachers with the respect they deserve to say, look, let's show you what we know about development, about learning, about intelligence. Let's help you see that in the kids that are under your stewardship. I think we can get a long way. Meanwhile, those of us that are operating on the system instead of in it can do our work in trying to transform that system so it is actually working along with the teacher and on behalf of students. But again, I think we can do some things right now that we're just not doing.
100%. And I love the things that you're saying. There's a gap in the interpersonal story though I want to elucidate for our listeners. Now, you said you were a high school dropout. Now we fast forward and you just said you were in college. So what happened there in between?
I'd like to say it was like super intentional, but it was like for 2 years after dropping out, I worked a string of minimum wage jobs, like the kind of jobs you could get if you don't have a high school diploma, right? And it culminated, you know, I was the 4:30 person in the morning at Einstein's Bagels. I sold televisions, cell phones. I literally, with my wife, we had a paper route. Like my wife was selling blood plasma, like, you know, just to get by. We ended up on welfare.
That's bonding. Bonding,
yeah. Yeah. That is bonding. It's her. Like, hey honey, ready for our paper route? You're not too weak from giving blood. You know, we were on welfare, which was a pretty humiliating experience in and of itself and really shaped a lot of the views I have right now about, you know, the way we treat people who face poverty. But the job I had before I made this change, there's no kidding, I was giving enemas for a living because as a home health associate, because it paid $1.50 more an hour than the job I'd had and I needed the money. And listen, it's honest work and somebody has to do it. I'm just glad it's not me anymore. And
was that like a professional dominatrix context?
Yeah, no, that would have been great. This was people who couldn't get out of the house and needed that help and they didn't want me there and I didn't want to be there. And, you know, so, you know, at the time, a lot of my, on my wife's side, they were really frustrated with me and rightfully so. Like I'd just taken their daughter from them and, and I couldn't seem to hold a job. And my father-in-law said, he actually told me that I know the problem is that you're lazy. And I started to internalize that, like maybe that's just me. And luckily my dad, I happened to share that with him one day and he said, you know, I don't think that it's that you're lazy. I think that you just always have to be motivated. Cause he said, like, when you're motivated, you're as good as anybody. And when you're not, you're not. And there's like no in between, which is definitely true. He nailed that. I would be the worst employee on the planet unless I really care about what I'm doing. And he said, you know, there's a path for you where you could make good money doing things that you love, but you can't get there where you are right now. And he said, you probably either need to start a business or you need to go to school. And since I had $13 in my bank account, which is probably a lie, I don't think probably less than that. I was like, well, I don't know the first thing about business. So I said, well, you know, and here's what's really cool. So I chose to get my GED and go start at night school at Weber State, which is an open enrollment school in Ogden, Utah. And it's funny, when I graduated as an honor student of the year, got into Harvard, the first time a reporter ever talked to me was around this story. And the first question she asked is like, wait, hold on. Why would you have thought it would be a good idea to try your hand at school again? And I just, like, it never dawned on me that like my absolute failure, like, would suggest that I couldn't do it. And the reason why is my dad was the first high school graduate in our family. And he was a mechanic. And I remember when I was in grade school, he came home and he said, look, I think there's something more for me. And he decided he was going to go to school at night while he worked during the day and he became a mechanical engineer. And he just retired. And I have to say, he always hates it when I brag about him. So sorry, Dad, if you're listening, that he went and became a mechanical engineer, worked at Autoliv. And he has so many patents on airbags. He is like responsible for so many innovations in that field that have saved so many people's lives. And it's like to recognize that, and I lived through that. I saw us go from living in a rural part of the country, solidly working class, to becoming middle class. And, you know, and I saw it change him as a person. And so when it came time to thinking about my own, like, how do I turn my life around? It was in some ways a lot easier for me than it was for him because I had a clear model, right? I had an example of the awesome power of education to transform lives and life circumstances. So I went to the same school he went to. Right? And
wow. Where did he go to college?
Weber State University, Ogden, Utah.
Okay.
Wildcats, okay. You know, Damian Lillard.
Go Wildcats.
Yeah. So we've got some good ones there. But it was very cheap, but even then I couldn't afford very much. My family and even my in-laws cobbled together what they had. And they said, this can get you through 1 year. Mm-hmm. But if you can't get a scholarship, that's it. And so it was really out of desperation that I had to figure it out. And the best advice my dad told me was that, listen, you should listen to other people, but we should go ahead and assume that whatever you were doing before didn't work, right? So like, I just knew that I had to figure out how to make it work for myself. And it became really clear that knowing who I was and making decisions based on that was the way forward. I can tell you there's one story, I'm just chewing up scenery here, but that changed my life forever in this frame of understanding your individuality and creating that fit. You know, it's about 2 years into Weber State. I was doing fine. And I was sitting in a big auditorium in a history class next to my buddy Steve. And I was kind of complaining about how boring that class was because I couldn't get out of it. It was a required class, big auditorium. And it's just the worst kind of situation for me for learning. And he says, well, man, this is nothing compared to what I got myself into. And he tells me he's in this thing they called the honors program. And in my mind, honors was just the same stuff, only more work, right? So I was like, that's a sucker's bet. Like, yeah. Who would do that? But no. He's like, no, you got it wrong. He's like, it's so much worse. He's like, there are no tests. You just have to write stuff. He's like, can't hide in an auditorium. They're small rooms. And he's like, I'm not even sure they're right answers. All we do is debate things. And I was like, this sounds amazing. Like amazing, right? So I was so impulsive. The class ends and I rush to the honors program. It was above the library at the top of the hill. And I go right in and I tell the secretary, a woman named Marilyn Diamond, I said, I'd like to be in the honors program. And she said, well, great. Let's see if we get you an appointment. So luckily the director's right there. He sees me and he says, okay, great. You want to be in the honors program? He's like, I just have a few questions. We're really proud of this program. And how did you do on the ACT? That was the, you know, we took that to the SAT. And I told him the number, which, you know, I was the lower end of the curve. Right? And he goes, to his credit, he goes, well, don't worry. Not everyone's good at standardized tests. What was your high school GPA? Like, this is no kidding.
Yeah, there we go.
This is no kidding.
0.9.
Yeah. I said 0.9, and there's no joke. He says, what 0.9? And I said, 0.9. and he was so nice about it, but he goes, look, you can't be in the honors program, right? And he didn't say this, but I heard we have standards, so you can't be in the honors program, right? And I was like so embarrassed because I hadn't thought it through. So I just rushed up there, and I'm just sitting there, and I just wanted to crawl in a hole, right? So I'm like, oh, okay, I'm sorry. Thank you so much. We stood up. I reached across the desk, shook his hand, and I went to leave. And I walked out the door, and Marilyn Diamond, the secretary, her desk was right by the door. And I walked past. She reached out and grabbed my arm. And she said, hey, I heard the conversation. If you want this, don't take no for an answer. And I was like, wait, you can do that? Like, you can, like... And she said, just sit on the couch and don't leave until he lets you in. And I sat there and it felt like forever. The director came out to go teach a class. And he's like, what are you doing? I said, well, I want to be in the honors program. He said, you can't be in the honors program, right? And he came back and it had to have been a few hours all told. And then he pokes his head out and he says, you know, Todd, come back in here. And I went back in and he said, listen, tell me why you want to be in the honors program, because I don't get it, right? And so I explained to him what I'd learned about myself and why I thought this was a good fit, even though in truth, I should have been in remedial classes in a lot of places, right? And he said, look, I can't let you in straight in, but what I'll do is I'll give you a provisional status. And here's what I mean. You choose one honors class. And if you do well, I'll let you take another one. And we'll go from there. And so I chose wisely. I was like, okay, I got to pick something. It was called Plagues of the Modern Era. First of all, it almost made me vegan because I couldn't eat meat forever. But I did really well. It was such a perfect fit. And so you just do this. And then suddenly, again, I'm graduating as the honor student of the year. And like, wow. For me, it's like on paper, you'd say, well, obviously someone who literally had to take remedial math, because I failed algebra three times in high school. And, you know, why would you think honors would be a better fit? But you realize that's because we still think about this kind of thing like ability in this old way that is just completely hamstrung us, right? And so is the honors program right for everyone? Of course not. It certainly wasn't right for my buddy Steve, who was plenty smart, right? For me, it was perfect. And it prepared me for Harvard in a way that nothing else could have. And so, you know, for that, it's like both tells me a lot about context again, but then also back to these relationships, right? And I'll tell you something so funny just to end this part of the story and let you talk for a minute, right? So I came back just a few years ago back to Weber State because they were giving me an award for, you know, whatever, not completely screwing up my life. And Marilyn Diamond was there. And she was in the audience. And I thought, well, what a great opportunity to acknowledge this person and their influence. Mm-hmm. Because in my mind, I had held her up as this, she saw something in me, right? Mm-hmm. And I told the story that I just shared with you. And they asked her to come up. And the first thing she says is, you know, I don't remember that. And I said, wait, you don't remember that? Like, this was like the most important thing. I mean, and it wasn't because I was that forgettable. It turned out that almost everybody had a Marilyn Diamond story.
She did that a lot.
She was that kind of person. She believed in people's potential and she took action on it, right? So I, you know, I'm so grateful for the life I get to lead right now. It would be the height of arrogance to pretend that it's just about some innate ability independent of situation and including other people and their willingness to believe in me.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm really glad we went down that rabbit hole, so to speak, because it's so profound and I have chills. It's really speaks to this thing I've been trying to understand my whole life, which is what is the real intelligence? You know, there's this idea that if you measure it on the IQ test, that's the real intelligence. And then if the person shows any intelligence outside of that, it doesn't count. And it's such a narrow way of thinking about human potential, and it's limiting. It's so limiting. It also can create, as it did for me for many years, an imposter syndrome kind of thing. Because in a similar story, I'm very much relating to your story. I was rejected from gifted ed because my IQ score was not high enough. My senior year of high school, I wanted to go from special ed to gifted ed. So I tried again to gifted ed and they rejected me because my IQ score. But the gifted ed teacher let me in unofficially my senior year. And she told me at the end, she said, "You're the most gifted, not actually gifted person I've ever had in my gifted ed classroom," which gave me an imposter syndrome because it's like, then what's the real, what counts, right? Do you know what I mean? There's something really profound here.
Do you know what's funny is Benjamin Bloom, you know, that invented mastery learning.
Yeah.
Once said he had a student who was studying the way we admit into gifted programs using IQ tests. And she asked him about it. And he said, "That is exactly how ungifted people would select for gifted programs." Like, it was like the worst possible way
exactly.
We could do it.
Yeah.
No. So interesting. Because again, when you have a bell curve, there's always somebody that's in the top 5%. Even if nobody's very good at something, somebody has to be in the top. And it means that there's a lot of people, like everybody could be good at it, but somebody has to lose on those measures, right? And what they found in that research, if I remember it correctly, the gist of it was this, which is when they studied randomized trials about like how people select into gift programs using IQ, using other metrics, the one that won out in terms of kids get in there and do really well and stay in was literally showing kids what was required and letting them choose for themselves. Because look, if you're not good at something and you don't care, you're not going to take on the extra burden that comes with the work in a gifted program. Are you kidding me? Right? Mm-hmm. But I just never forgot that. It's so it turns out that the kids themselves were better at deciding whether they should be in a gifted program than any other test we've created.
I love that. I love that. So true. Well, were you in special education as a kid? Like, what was your diagnosed, if you can reveal that?
No, so
what was going on with you there?
Yeah. So look, I was always like hyperactive and, you know, whatever, like, which to this day, it bothers me to no end. This whole disease model of this, we've pathologized natural human variation. It doesn't mean that some kids don't need help, including medicine, whatever, but it's just garbage to treat it as if we're talking about something like cancer or something like that. But anyway, so I have terrible working memory. I'm a little overactive, and rather than accept, I'm really grateful. My mom is the most stubborn person I know in the best possible way, right? Grew up in ultra religious rural part of the country where women weren't really viewed in the same way that, you know, they should be viewed. And she wasn't taking any of that, right? So I learned a lot about fighting for yourself from her and not accepting other people's definition of who you are. And so, you know, take the working memory thing. I now believe I'm probably the most organized person that I know. And I was incredibly disorganized. You wouldn't believe it. When I was in school, younger as a kid, I would literally sometimes do my homework and then forget to bring it back to school. Right. Like, you know, I couldn't organize myself and manage my time. Well, what changed for me is when I was in grad school, actually, I realized I better get a handle on this. And I studied not from a deficit standpoint, but elite. Like, what do people like CEOs? So how do they manage these incredible, daily workloads? And I found, you're probably familiar with Getting Things Done, right? If you're not, completely changed my life. You know, but it was written for executives, because the thing about working memory, right, is it's not, we all have terrible working memory. It's a limiting thing on purpose. Neurologically, it's not like we have it. But what's interesting about working memory is it's called like catastrophic loss of information, which is, doesn't matter if you have this much or this much, as soon as it overflows, it's not like a glass with a little bit spilling over, the network fails, right? And so what I learned from this was you could build a system with your technology and your habits that offload and automate so much of this. And to this day, that's how I live my life. I mean, I have it on my phone, I have it on my computer, and it changed everything for me. And so to me, this gets back to like, if you just see it as natural human variation in context with strategies tied to that, you can figure out a way to turn even things that are deficits into strengths. And I wish, like, we don't think of it that way. We don't teach kids to think of it that way, because we're still locked into this silly idea that there's some innate ability that some smart people can figure out in advance and decide who gets resources, who doesn't, who deserves opportunity, who doesn't. And that approach is demonstrably wrong, right? Like, and so anyway, I'll get off my high horse on that. But my life and your life probably too is a testament to this way of thinking about human potential. And sometimes when people hear my story, they're like, "Well, look, talented people find a way through." And I'm like, "Cool, that's good. That makes me. You're telling me I'm really talented. Okay." But like, I look at it and go, yeah, that's not really the takeaway, because I can promise you, for every one of me or every one of you, there are so many other people that didn't have the same opportunity, didn't have the same relationships, and have never had the chance to live up to their full potential. And it doesn't just affect them and the kind of fulfilling life they can lead. It affects all of us, because we're all missing their contribution.
Yeah, absolutely. No, hear. What do you make of the correlation, though, between IQ and so many societally outcomes? And I mean, there is a whole nexus. I wrote an article called IQ and Society for Scientific American about this, because it's so hard to untangle the correlations and look at causations, because we set up a society where that gating mechanism allows you even the opportunity to get to the next level. And then we kind of create that system. Then we say, look. All the people with high IQs are the only ones who are allowed at the top, right? So I just wanted to nerd out with you about that a second. What are your thoughts?
Two things. Correlation is wildly misleading, because the right number there is actually like an R squared number, right? It's variance explained. And correlation, I think, gives the impression that you're explaining more than you really are. So let's take something in psychology, because when we talk about the correlations, you're usually talking about somewhere 0.3, 0.4. If you found a 0.5, you'd probably do cartwheels, right? Like, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, because you did the work. So, okay, let's take a correlation of 0.4, which in psychology we would call, that's a That's a pretty good correlation, right? You are explaining exactly 16% of the variance. Now, if I said it that way, what would your takeaway be? Your takeaway would be, maybe we don't really know what's going on with this phenomenon if all you can do is explain 16% of the variance. If your mechanic said, listen, I am an expert, I can explain 16% of what goes on with your car, you would not pat them on the back and be like, yeah, good job, right? So that's the first thing. Let's just be clear. Second of all, if you think about it, in normal nature, you have what's called dynamic stability, right? Which is variation of the input, so like a human being, and variation in the environment, right? Hmm. When you take and standardize something like the environment, which we did, which we've done for the last 100 and something years, right? As soon as you reduce the variation in the environment, it starts to make variation in biology look predictive, right? Hmm. So like, for example, if I decide everything is a reading test, which that's most of school, right? Like, then, and we know that people naturally vary in terms of reading ability. Reading is something we literally made up. It is artificial. It's not like language, which you can just acquire. You have to be taught how to read, right? People vary in that. Well, if everything is a reading test, then genetic and neurological variation related to reading ability will look predictive of a whole bunch of outcomes. And we can pat ourselves on the back and say, look how good of a job we did. We've discovered what causes all these accomplishments. But that's not really the whole story. What you've done is figure out what correlates with an outcome that you have artificially constrained. Right? Like, so, you know, we do this over and over again. And, you know, it's funny. It's like, and we think we're learning more. And I'm not trying to dismiss that. Like, I think that it's not that there's nothing there. But to me, what I'm looking at is, what if you look at it the other way and say, if I believe everyone has the ability to be excellent at something, and my job is to create the environment that cultivates that so we all benefit from it, then I would be trying to understand human variation, not from a selection process, but from a design process, right? How do I accommodate the widest range of variation possible? So look, that was a long-winded way of saying, look, I think those correlations are true. And I think they are both wildly are explaining a lot less than we believe they are, because we talk about correlation instead of R square. And the right takeaway when I see those correlations is how much of that is just a function of artificially standardizing an environment that didn't need to be standardized.
Yeah. Yeah. This has been one of the hardest things for me to reconcile in my career, because I know my personal experiences, and I know the experience of so many people who have fallen through the cracks because of the standard program. Yet I also am aware of the science of IQ, and I don't want to sweep the actual science under the rug at all. So trying to reconcile all this has been very, very, very difficult, because people come back at you and say, as they have come back to me and say, well, you know, science, if you can predict that much variance explained, that's actually more than almost any other construct in the entire field of psychology variance explained. But then we could say, well, then maybe the whole field of psychology sucks.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's an indictment of psychology. Listen, I did my postdoc. I did my postdoc at the Center for Astrophysics, the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, where I got to work with really amazing astrophysicists who also used things like multiple regression and other things. And in that field, if you don't have an R square of like, if you're not explaining 99% of the variance, go home, right?
So forget it.
Whenever I would bring this, I'm like, look at the model we've developed. And they're like, you can only explain 20%. And they're like, you don't understand the phenomena, the phenomenon that you're actually investigating. Go back to the drawing board, right? And I just feel like it's like, I'm not trying to dismiss, like, I think we've made important contributions. I think IQ is measuring something, right? I am just of the opinion that I don't know what the value proposition is. I just don't. I think if we go back to what we talked about earlier, which is, if I was going to use an IQ test, if some parent or teacher said, should I give this kid an IQ test? I'd say, if you are using it to identify a Jagged profile in order to understand strengths and weaknesses, the pattern, in order to create a better environment that allows them to thrive, then go for it. If you are using it to decide whether this kid is worth anything at all, then you are misusing that tool.
You said something very key there. You said, use it to help them thrive. That's what's missing from even like, so the CHC model, you know, Cattell Horn, like Carol, you know, and then they have like they have other like new ones within the psychometric world.
Yeah.
They argue very much. So Kevin McGrew has argued we need to de-emphasize the global IQ score and pay attention to patterns of strength and weakness on the test.
Yep.
But the emphasis is usually so we can help get them the remediation they need. The step you took was a different step, which I'm on board. I'm right there with you, brother, which is like, okay, can't we do better than that? Can't we do better than just using that information of their jagged profile to help them remediate? Can't we actually use a broader set of information about the human to help them thrive and self-actualize?
And by the way, like, it doesn't mean that people aren't going to need remediation sometimes. Of course they will, right?
Right. And I love Kevin McGrew's work. I love his work.
Of course. No, me too. And look, I think it's really good. And I think that, so there is a remediation aspect, but think about when we go to that pathology view of human variation, those kids end up being the only kids who spend most of their time on things they're not very good at. Like, I don't know any model of human excellence that starts with find the things you suck at and have to work on those and spend no time on the things that you're passionate about or actually good at. Like, what kind of advice is that, right? And I'll tell you one thing like that really blew my mind is
shitty advice.
When I was in grad school, like I was part of a project that's back to this universal design for learning, that it was for like sixth grade science notebook stuff, right? Like the inquiry science. Mm-hmm. And it was a randomized trial of traditional science notebooks versus this digital version that had embedded all those flexibility, like vocabulary support, different ways of representing the same scientific information. And it was being done in South Carolina as one of the states in some schools. And like there was this one kid who was profoundly reading impaired, like profoundly reading impaired. And the teacher had said she had signed up. She hated technology, but she was willing to do this if it could reach this kid. Cause she's like, he's got a scientific mind. Right. And I'm telling you, like, if I weren't part of this, I wouldn't have believed it. But over the course of 12 weeks, we kept getting reports about this kid doing better and better and better and better. When we went back and did the final observations, I walked into the classroom, no kidding. And they were in their science, doing their science work. And probably half the class was huddled around this one kid's desk. And he was like holding court. Like he was explaining everything to people. And it was like, it turned out he was so dang good at this. But because he was struggling to read and everything was a reading test, he looked like he didn't know much about science. Right. And he had started to internalize that. And all we did was remove that artificial, arbitrary obstacle. We already know that he's struggling to read. Okay. So this kid definitely does need remediation. That's part of my point, right? That's not going to fix itself. Mm. Fine. But it turns out he's really gifted in this science and everybody knew it, right? And all we did was remove the arbitrary obstacle, right? And so I feel like, you know, I'm not someone who's saying everybody is amazing and no one ever has to struggle or no one has limitations. What I'm saying is when we have too narrow of a view of human potential, it just drives us into a ditch and we don't need to do that. And the work you've done, the folks like Kurt Fisher, so we know a lot more about not only the nature of human potential, but what it takes to cultivate it in a way that I believe is scalable. And so to me, the thing that's holding us back from having that kind of society is not our technology, not our know-how, but our will to do it. And so I get a little, you know, frustrated because I'm just like, you know, I want people to have the same kind of experiences that you and I have had, right? There is nothing better. I know we've talked about this before. It's amazing to live the kind of lives we're living. I mean, we get to wake up every day and pursue the things we're passionate about, right? And I'd like to believe we're making some contributions, and I want that for everybody.
Beautiful, beautiful. And another step towards that direction seems to be expanding the whole idea of what counts as a strength. Right? Because in a school system, there's such a focus on the cognitive, right? Like it's hard for IQ test makers when they look at their jagged profile of like of like GF, GC, you know, like fluid intelligence, Chris, to think, well, there's actually a broader array of what counts as a strength as a human, right? Like, what about compassion? What about, well, you know, authenticity? What about, you know what I mean?
For me, I've found things like talent and even intelligence, while I know they are real as constructs, I find them not a good starting point, because to me, it's about contribution. Like, what I want is a society where people are doing things that are fulfilling to them and making their best contribution. And in my view, your best contribution is likely, and things that are most fulfilling are going to be related to your own individuality, things that matter to you, things that you're good at, right? And so I'm like, how about we could acknowledge that for the last 100 years, we've tried to play this game of pretending we understand what human potential is and how to select for it. And if we're honest with ourselves, I'd say we are mediocre at that at best. And it's one thing when you're doing that with your own life. It's a whole nother thing when you are condemning entire generations of kids to our assumptions about what human potential is. I don't think that's fair. And I don't think it is even, it's demonstrably false. And so it is unacceptable to me as a scientist to continue with assumptions that we know are incorrect when it has real world consequences for people's lives, both individually and collectively, because again, we are missing out on enormous amounts of contribution. And so if we can get past that and realize a better assumption in my mind is that everybody is capable of excellence of some kind, and that because of the complexity of human beings, no person is smart enough to know in advance what any one person is capable of doing. But we do know the conditions that everyone needs to be able to thrive, and we can work like crazy to ensure that every kid in this country has that.
Todd, I couldn't agree with you more, and I would say you've made a major contribution, not just a little bit of contribution. You have a lot of humility, so it's better for me to say this, but you really have made a major contribution. I just love the way you're moving the needle on our thinking. However, I'm now in a bit of a quagmire because we just spent an hour talking about, I should have predicted that we would, once we got started on this, was a long time coming. Should we hold off on a discussion about collective for another time? What do we do in this?
If I were king for a day, this is what I propose. I would love to do a part two, because I think Collective Illusions, the book that's out now, is really important and relevant to the time we're living in. And I'd love to give it a full, and that gives me excuse to come back and talk to you. So I if you want to do that, I will come back whenever you tell me to, and we'll do part two.
Todd, I love it. Why don't we in the next month schedule a part two recording? And then what I'll do is I'll release, you'll be 2 full weeks of the Psychology Podcast. I'll release them back to back.
Look at that.
So we'll have part one, and then the following week will be part two. So it'll be a lot.
That'll be amazing.
It'll be great.
That'd be amazing. Okay, well, let's do it. I'll prioritize it. I'll make the time as soon as you're ready.
Beautiful. Thank you, Todd, so much for being on my podcast today, and for your just humility, passion, spirit, intelligence, really extraordinary intelligence, being on the show today.
Well, thanks for having me, and to all our colleagues who do really good work in psychometrics and intelligence. You know, forgive me for, you know, being a little passionate about it. I do appreciate the work that's going on. We may have different assumptions, but there's a lot of good work by honest, decent people, really intelligent people, that, you know, I don't want to dismiss out of hand. But
of course, they'll get over it.
Or we'll hear about it on Twitter. Yeah, it'll be okay.
Yeah. Thanks, Todd. It was a real pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com or on our YouTube page, The Psychology Podcast. We also put up some videos of some episodes on our YouTube page as well, so you'll want to check that out. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the show, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.